total weaponization of the world's reserve currency. And that's already a huge problem for the US out there, because we've weaponized the dollar long ago, you know, and we use the power of having the world's reserve currency to bully other countries.
Commodities are the cheapest they've ever been against the stock market. Gold and silver are the cheapest they've ever been against commodities, and the gold, silver stocks are the cheapest they've ever been against gold.
Hey guys, today you're in for a treat. I have Bob Moriarty and John Rubino. John Rubino is a former Wall Street financial analyst and author or co-author of five different books, including The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops, and Clean Money, Picking Winners in the Green Tech Boom. He founded the popular financial website dollarcollapse.com in 2004, sold it in 2022, and now publishes John Rubino's Substack newsletter at rubino.substack.com. Bob Moriarty has his own Wikipedia page, which I credit this bio to. He's an American Marine F-4B fighter pilot who holds the record as the youngest naval aviator, age 20, in the Vietnam War, achieving the rank of captain in the Marines at age 22. Before leaving the military service in 1970, he recorded 824 combat missions. He holds 14 international aviation records, including the record for flight time between New York to Paris in two different categories. He's the owner and publisher of 321gold.com, where he publishes and reviews different money stocks from around the world. I have known the work of both John and Bob for the past several years, and I am now pleased to be interviewing them together in person and can call them both my friends. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. Thank you.
How's it going, guys?
Great, Andy. Good. Thanks for having us on.
You're very welcome. Bob, let's start with you here. What's your 30,000-foot view of everything? And let's start with the economy.
I look down and I see a porcupine taking a bubble bath, and it doesn't make any difference what he does. He's going to burst a few bubbles. John is eminently more qualified to discuss the economy than I am, but 2024 is going to be a year of total chaos. We've got so many black swans. The Trump trial that's going on now, the Trump trial in Georgia, the election, the Russian-Ukraine thing, the $96 billion poured down the hole. There are some really scary things, and it's a good time for investors to be ultra cautious.
Yeah, I would agree with you. John, what's your 30,000-foot view on where we're at in time in this year?
Well, the porcupine analogy is a good one. You know, we've blown, they call it the everything bubble now for a reason, because there are so many different things out there that could blow up. And to flesh out the story just a little bit, where we are now is the result of an experiment that we started in 1971 with fiat currencies, where we basically did away with the backing of the world's major currencies, took gold out of the equation, and gave the big governments an effectively unlimited credit card. And, you know, human nature being what it is, they've abused that privilege to the point where everybody at every level in every major country is wildly over indebted, which means we're pretty much guaranteed chaos going forward. And the nature of chaos is that it's not predictable in its specifics, but in kind of a broad brush analysis, it's very predictable. You know, wild, crazy things are going to happen when the various bubbles start blowing up. And Bob is exactly right. We need protection from the chaos. And that should be kind of the overriding investment thesis here is, what can we do to make ourselves resilient and to an extent impervious to financial crises? Because that's what we've got coming our way in one way or another.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. And I want to get to that probably the second half of this talk. And it's really, I find it I guess it's, I find it not helpful when we don't share, if you would, a path or just a way or just to give encouragement of people what to do, some kind of direction, not advice, but just give some people some kind of direction. John, let's go again with you is where are we at in the banking system? Bob and I talked about just how the banking system, for lack of a better word, it's starting to get gummed up right now and is starting to hit right now. What's your opinion on all of that?
Yeah, over the past decade or so, we had a naturally low interest rates. So a lot of commercial real estate in particular got planned and designed and built using really cheap financing. Well, now a lot of those debts are coming due now. And there's no way a big chunk of the country's office buildings are still financially viable if they have to refinance at today's interest rates. So you're seeing, right. You know, every 2 weeks or so, there's a story about some $180 million office building that sold for $12 million or something like that. Well, now that means there are embedded losses in commercial real estate. And somebody has to take those losses. And a lot of that bad paper is on the balance sheets of local and regional banks. So in the year ahead, well, actually, it's an ongoing thing. It's happening now, but in the year ahead, it's going to get worse. A lot of local and regional banks are going to have to report those losses. And that's going to spook their depositors into pulling money out, which forces them to sell some of those depreciated assets and take even bigger losses and so on until the banks start to fail. Then that spreads through the sector. The U.S. government has to step in and bail them out. And then that shifts the, potentially, it shifts pressure over to the currencies because, you know, who wants to own the currency of a country that's doing yet another multi-trillion dollar bailout? So that might be the story of the next year where a banking crisis leads to some kind of a broader crisis in the financial markets.
Yeah. Well, we talked about this and you nailed it. It was hitting, I think it was, this was last, my memory fails me, but this was about a month ago, I want to say. What's your opinion on where we're at in the banking system right now?
Well, I've got the details on what John was just talking about. It was the AT&T building in St. Louis, and it once had a value of $200 million, and it sold at auction at $3.5 million. That is across the board in commercial real estate, and frankly, I've never heard of losses like that. So the banking system should have crashed in 2008, but we bailed it out. And it should have crashed a year ago in March, and we bailed it out. And the bank term loan facility ended on March 11th. The banks will start reporting earnings this month. And the banking system is far worse shape now than it was a year ago, and it's far worse shape than it was in 2008. And one of these days, it's going to break. Now, Here's two things going on that I think are going to be important. Now, you know, I like to ask questions that are impossible to answer. Do you have any idea of how much the United States gives to Israel yearly?
I have no clue.
$3.3 billion. Now, in the $95 or $96 billion bailout that Congress just passed, how much is reserved for Israel?
I have no idea.
$26
billion. Wow.
Okay. Now, if you're donating $3.5 billion a year and you decide to up the allowance to $26 billion, that comes under the, are you kidding me?
Right.
I mean, you can't possibly be serious. And something that is part of the bill that they passed was to steal the Russian assets that are available to the United States and donate the money to the most corrupt nation in the world. And that is so insane. The Ukrainians lost the war in March of 2022. And they came to the table and they agreed to go back to the lines prior to February 2022. And NATO and Boris Johnson said, don't do it. By stealing the Russian assets, They have just told every nation on earth, if we disagree with you, we're going to steal all the assets we can. I believe there's a good chance that's going to be the kiss of death to the dollar. The banking system is one giant black swan, and the dollar is the other black swans, and they may crash together.
Yeah, John, what's your opinion on that? Or what do you? I think that's very insightful, Bob. What's your opinion on what Bob just said?
Well, yeah, we did do two things. We allocated another $100 or so billion for other countries at a time when the U.S. economy is imploding. At least our cities are imploding, and U.S. culture is in grave danger right now. And yeah, the idea that we're going to take another country's sovereign assets and use it to fight a war against that country is completely insane. You know, it's a total weaponization of the world's reserve currency. And that's already a huge problem for the U.S. out there, because we've weaponized the dollar long ago, you know, and we use the power of having the world's reserve currency to bully other countries. If they step out of line from the U.S. empire's dictates, we kick them out of the SWIFT international bank clearing system, or we sanction a bunch of their exports or imports or whatever. And we basically punish them using the dollar. So everybody wants out from under dollar hegemony out there. And this is just going to accelerate that process. Who's going to store reserve assets in London or New York after this? Nobody, you know, and nobody in their right mind anyhow. And so that's going to accelerate the de-dollarization process, which is already underway, and which is not going to wipe out the dollar, but it's going to diminish the power of the dollar and therefore the U.S.'s influence in the world. And it's a bad trend from that point of view.
Yeah. If you could work that out too, I had Andy Shechtman on with Miles Franklin about, a week ago. And he talked about how this has already gone, what you just said, John, it's already going on with the BRICS nations. There is a pause that I would have in the sense of, if not the dollar, and I'm agreeing with everything both of you guys have said, but if not the dollar, then what? I guess, as the reserve currency.
Okay.
Let's
what
go
did Napoleon
on.
Do?
What?
What did Napoleon do?
Tell me what Napoleon did. He invaded.
Yeah, but how did he pay for it?
How did he pay for it? Tell me.
He went to gold and silver.
Right. Okay. So let's take that, and I'm agreeing, but I want to work that out. I want to hear it from you. So he went to gold and silver. That means that gold and silver would have to be significantly repriced. And I'm not talking repriced as in like $2,500 an ounce for gold and $50 an ounce for silver. I'm talking 5, 10, well, I don't know the number, 20 times the current price that it's at.
You just made a fundamental error in logic.
Okay, tell me.
When you're talking about the price of gold, how many commodities are you talking about?
The price of gold? I'm talking about one commodity, gold.
Okay, but what's it priced in?
Dollars.
Thank you. You're talking about two commodities. You're
right.
Talking about gold, and you're talking about the dollar. A really interesting thing, but it should be obvious to everyone. Gold doesn't change its value. An ounce of gold 2,000 years ago, it's an ounce of gold today, period. Okay? It's the currency that changes its value. And I applaud people who understand the price of gold. It's going to appear going higher. But the flaw to it is try to price gold in Zimbabwe dollars, and it's a waste of time. The dollars buy more. The real key of what Napoleon did, the French went through two different currencies from 1789 until 1800, when Napoleon took over. They had the assignat, and then they had the mandat, both of which failed, both went into hyperinflation. Total chaos, France. People couldn't eat. Food couldn't be delivered to the cities. Napoleon stepped in. He shot a bunch of people. And he went back to gold and silver. You have to have an honest money to have an honest economy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. John, what are your thoughts on what Bob just shared?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting thread that runs through the Napoleon story, which is that when you have a hyperinflation, when you destroy the currency of a country, you also kind of destroy the culture, because all the people who trusted the country are the ones who get impoverished because they're holding the country's currency when it's inflated away. And so they tend to look to a strong leader to save them from all the carnage financially and culturally. And so they're open to a dictatorship. You know, you had Napoleon after the hyperinflation in France, and you had Hitler after the hyperinflation in Germany. So that explains a lot of today's politics, right? People are basically willing to put the Constitution aside in the U.S. if somebody's willing to come in and clean house. And so that's one of the real dangers, besides the whole financial crisis, currency reset thing, which is clearly coming here.
Right.
But we're looking at an authoritarian government in the same process. And that's what makes this so scary. You know, financial crises happen and you get through them. But it's when it's a financial crisis followed by some kind of dictatorship, that's a whole different animal. And that's what worries me about today is that, you know, a lot of the trends are pointing in the direction of, another Napoleon, another Hitler or something like that, taking control of a big part of the world.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And it makes it terrifying. Let me ask you, John, this is, before we move on, is there anything, because of your background, is there anything that we should be looking for or aware of right now that could be hitting the banking system as we speak or within the next few weeks or few months? Is there something that we need to be aware of?
Well, you know, weeks and months are very hard to predict. And I've learned never to try, you know, the old saying, predict a thing or a time, but don't predict it both. And so I have no idea what's going to happen in the next few weeks or a few months. But the big picture is kind of baked into the cake. You know, we borrowed way too much money. And in order to finance all this debt, we have to create enough currency that's going to devalue the currency in some fundamental way. So that's the overarching thing. Now, in the short run now, we've got cross currents, especially in the U.S. economy, where on the one hand, the U.S. government is running massive deficits. We're at like $1.5 trillion a year right now, heading for $2 trillion. And that's very stimulative because they're just making money out of thin air and dumping it into the banking system. On the other hand, you've got all this debt out there that is being repriced and spiking everybody's interest costs. So personal interest expense, which is what, you know, we three and everybody else has to pay on our debts, is going straight up. And the government's interest expense is going straight up too. And those are fundamentally deflationary because they make it hard to pay off debts and lead to defaults. So we've got this kind of, you know, this mountain of bad paper, which is very deflationary out there. And we've got a government that's just running massive deficits, which is inflationary. And so that's why we got this kind of stasis economy right now, where inflation is above the Fed's targets and it's not going down. But the economy is, it's providing mostly enough jobs for people, but there are more and more layoffs out there at the same time and more defaults on credit cards. So one of those trends will probably win. And, you know, I have no idea which one it'll be in the next year or two, but we either have kind of deflationary crash like in 2008, or we have rising inflation and then we get the 1970s on steroids. And I honestly don't know which one it's going to be. You know, it seems like it could be either, depending on the decisions that are made going forward. Either one of them is a huge crisis for regular people. And that's why we should all be trying to protect ourselves as best we can against some kind of crisis, because something is definitely coming.
John, I wanted to open it up to you. You said you had some questions for Bob, so I wanted to give you that opportunity. I have many questions for Bob too, but I want to point to you. Go ahead and ask some questions.
What a coincidence. I got some questions for you.
You always turn it around and ask me questions. Then I can't answer. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Yeah, Bob, I do have a lot of questions for you. One of them is military, and I think you're uniquely qualified to answer this. But it seems like we're in the early part of a technological revolution now with what's going on in Ukraine and just what's being developed, where you've got this really high-priced, high-tech hardware out there, and you've got it being countered by swarms of cheap drones that almost anybody can make and almost anybody can send out in, you know, in the thousands. And is that changing the nature of asymmetric warfare so that our, you know, super high-tech fighter jets or our aircraft carriers aren't the unbeatable weapons that they used to be, because you can send out drones that in high enough numbers that can get through any kind of air defense and then cripple a lot of these multi-million dollar or billion dollar machines for, you know, a fraction of the cost or, you know, an order of magnitude lower cost. And does that change the battlefield going forward in a way that's really dangerous for the big powers?
Now it's time for me to ask a question of you, because the question is far more important than the answer. What changes were there in military hardware in the U.S. Civil War? What was introduced?
Ooh, you know, I want to say Gatling guns, but yes. I might have my timing wrong there.
That's one. What
okay,
else?
Let's see. There were cannons before that. There were... Yes. Were there rifles that you don't have to load with a plunger?
Meaningless.
Is that the change?
No. Nope. Submarines.
Oh.
Right? Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go to World War One. Okay. What military advance was there in World War One?
Now, I would say submarines for that and tanks. Winston Churchill gets credit for inventing the army tank and airplanes, right?
Very good. World War II.
Ooh. Jets, for sure.
No.
And at the end, nuclear weapons. No, not jets?
No.
Hmm.
What do jets fly off?
Oh,
aircraft carriers. Aircraft carriers. Okay. Vietnam.
Hmm. Well, then they had jets.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. And, high-altitude bombers, let's see. Stuff like napalm, these really weird, destructive things.
Helicopters.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you something that I haven't heard anyone else say, and it really staggers me. When Iran attacked Israel, it probably cost Iran $50 million for the 170 drones and 70 missiles and some hypersonic cruise missiles. It probably cost the UK, France, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, and the United States $3.5 billion. Who won?
Well, okay, that was kind of the question I was asking, I think. The guys with the cheap drones stand to win because their weapons work, but they're way less costly.
Exactly, because war, at the end of the day, is a factor of how much it costs. When the Germans sent their tanks to Ukraine, they were sending over $20 million tanks, and the Russians were blowing them up with $5,000 drones. That's one of the biggest changes in military hardware that I've ever seen. And literally, it was enough to rotate 180 degrees the power in the Middle East between Israel and Iran. I mean, it was an absolute amazing attack. And what's even more critical for the United States, the attack just proved that all this heavy, expensive techno stuff the U.S. produces doesn't work. And that's going to be a giant, giant, giant change. So people are talking about whether Iran's the good guys or whether they're the bad guys or whether Israel's committing genocide. And what they should be focused on is the shift in geopolitical power that's the biggest shift in 80 years. But you raised a really good question. Every war changes military hardware. And certainly every country in the world today is looking at Ukraine and looking at Israel and saying, we need to change our way of thinking. The asymmetric aspect of the war is absolutely amazing. When you can take out a $20 million tank for $5,000, that's really cheap. And let's take it back to my experience. When I was in Vietnam, I was flying the F-4, but I was also flying Cessna spotters. And we picked targets. It was the most dangerous airplane to fly in Vietnam. It was the smallest airplane in Vietnam, but it was the most effective because we got to pick the targets. They're doing that with $1,000 drones now. That's absolutely amazing. They have totally changed warfare.
So what does that mean for aircraft carriers in particular? For instance, what is an aircraft carrier? It's multi-billion dollars. And it, you know, constitutes the most powerful air force wherever it goes, right? But what happens if 10,000 drones get shot at an aircraft carrier?
You don't need $10,000 drones. You need one of those hypersonic missiles that Iran, Russia, and China have. If you go to a map that shows you where all the aircraft carriers the U.S. has are located physically right now, you'll notice none of them are near the Black Sea or near the Mediterranean or the Red Sea for a reason. They're undergoing maintenance back in the United States, and they're painting big circular targets on them.
Is that part of the same story, though, where these hardware, these machines that cost billions of dollars are no longer defensible anymore?
That's correct. What happened to battleships at Pearl Harbor?
Yeah.
They're glittering.
Yeah. Planes.
They were proven to be an absolute waste of time. And the aircraft carrier came into its time. But the aircraft carrier now is nothing but a portable target. And some of the aircraft, like the F-35, the U.S. debt formally is $34 trillion. $2 trillion went into the F-35. Only a third of the airplanes are airworthy at any given time. It's the biggest fiasco in U.S. military procurement history. It has shorter range than the airplanes that I flew 50 years ago. So the military-industrial complex needs to have a revaluation, but the Chinese equipment and the Russian equipment and the Iranian equipment is absolutely superior to that of the West.
So are we going to pick a fight and lose at some point in the not-too-distant future?
Why don't we ask how many wars have we won in the last 80 years? It's a lot easier question.
But see, we still think our military, if we got serious, the consensus in the world is that we would win any fight we get serious about winning. But could that turn out not to be true in a fight where we're serious?
Well, it has every time in the last 80 years. The Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, went in front of Congress last week, and he was asked, is there genocide in Gaza? And there was what's called a long pregnant silence. And Lloyd Austin clearly didn't want to answer the question, but he came back and said something to the effect of, well, we don't show any particular signs of it. Now, here's the deal from a guy who's actually been at war. It's genocide. Now, you can approve of it, as a lot of people do, but it's genocide. It is war crimes. It's babies being killed. It's 14,000 children being killed. They just unearthed few hundred people who had been buried in bags in a mass grave, and some of them were tied with their hands behind their back and their legs. What's going on is far worse than anything I ever heard of or saw, and the Secretary of Defense doesn't see it. The government of the United States is so corrupt. The DOJ is corrupt. The CIA is corrupt. The FBI is corrupt. They're going after Trump, who I frankly don't particularly like, and they have warped the law to do it. And where do you go when your Department of Justice has been corrupted? How do you advance from there? How do you get better? And the answer is, I think you have to have a civil war or a revolution.
Yeah, it does feel like we're kind of evolving a dictatorship here piece by piece, right? Where this part of the criminal justice system does this thing that it never should have done, and then the Congress does something else, and the NSA is spying on us in unconstitutional ways, and the CIA is spying on Americans, which it was never supposed to do. Those are all kind of separate things, but you put them together, and we're becoming a country where the secret police spy on us, where dissident political candidates get prosecuted like in a banana republic. So, it's a scary picture, and it's not something that we can really do anything about. That's what's so frustrating. That's kind of what drives me so deeply into the whole investing thing, because at least you can decide what to do with your finances. You know, you can't stop the CIA from doing whatever it's going to do, but you can protect yourself from the inevitable currency crisis that's going to flow from all this other stuff by investing in the right way personally. You know, I know that's kind of a narrow, self-centered point of view, but it's like that's the only place where we have control anymore. You know, it's the only psychologically safe space.
I think you have to address that, because it's very, I don't want to say very, but it's empowering. And I think that it's what we need to give people, especially, and I think about selfishly for myself and my family. I want to be empowered. And so I want some kind of control when stuff hits the fan or as it's hitting the fan. Bob, real quick, and I'd like to go into that next, but Bob, before we do that, Bob, do you have any questions for John?
I don't, but I would like the opportunity to make a comment. I've read he's an excellent writer, and he's been contributing for almost 30 years. And I think he should be appreciated for that.
That's nice. And you're right. We have been at this for a long time. There are videos of me saying a lot of the same stuff where I have black hair. Seriously, old videos.
I used to have hair.
Yeah, me too. 30 years ago. Bob, let me ask you this, and then I'll pose the same question to John. So let's empower people. What do people, if they haven't started, what do they need to do now? And I don't remember who had that saying, but hope is a terrible place to be. We don't want to rely on hope. We want some action. And I think that gives people hope. So let's start with you, and then John, I'll pose you the same question.
What we're going through, the world has gone through hundreds or perhaps thousands of times before and made it through. Another two authors I'll give credit to are the two authors of The Fourth Turning. They predicted exactly what's happening now 25 years ago. And they said, you're going to go into the fourth turning. It's a crisis phase, and you're going to have a large group of people trying to go to totalitarianism. And then you're going to have a smaller but growing group of people advocating for freedom. Now, someone came to stay with me recently, and she knows she lives in a college town. And in her off hours, she drives a Lyft, and she talks to these kids about finance, investing, and the world. And I will tell you that my belief is the average people in the United States right now are furious. And it's true of the Latins, it's true of the whites, and it's true of the blacks. when you look at what the United States is doing on the southern border, nobody tries to defend it, but we brought in, I think, 12 million illegal immigrants. And how are we better off? And then you see this obscenity of giving money to the most corrupt nation on earth that lost the war 2 years ago, and Israel that's in the midst of a genocide. There's something obscene about that. The American Secretary of State, Blinken, was talking about Ukraine, and he said that as far as the United States is concerned, it's a win-win because 90% of the money is coming right back to the United States to create well-paying American jobs. Now, of course, the flaw to that logic is somewhere between 700,000 and a million Ukrainian soldiers have been killed. So my question is, how many Ukrainian soldiers do we need to kill to generate one high-paying U.S. jobs? Some of the things the government is doing now, it is so corrupt, it is so obscene, and there are a lot of people who see it, and the government has gone too far. And when the banking system fails and they try to seize everybody's money and everybody's brokerage account, there will be a revolution.
So what poses the question then, so I'm a 30-year-old living in middle of America, what do I do?
Well, you take insurance policy. Have you got insurance on your car?
Of course.
You have insurance on your house?
Yeah, of course.
Why?
In case something happens to me and or something happens to my house and it's no longer has the value that it had.
But you don't care about your other assets?
I care about them, absolutely. I see
what you're
saying.
They got an insurance policy. Okay, the thing is, and I differentiate, I would love to hear John's comments on this. I differentiate from the gold bugs who say bye, 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 okay, who worship gold. I look at gold as an insurance policy against chaos, okay? You could see what's happened recently. Frankly, I think the correction is over. I think we're going to go right back up. The buying in gold and silver right now is controlled out of China, and I think it's a lot more powerful than people realize. And I think the United States is committing suicide financially and morally, and I think the people know it. And we have to educate them. And of course, that's what I do. And that's what John does. And that's what you do. We educate people and tell them why it's important for them to have an insurance policy. Forget, you know, gold going to 50,000. You need to have something that's going to have value when the banks close, because the banks are going to close.
John, what are your thoughts to that or your answers to that question?
Yeah, we should think of gold not as an investment, but as a form of money. So what you know, the savings you used to keep in dollars ought to be in gold now, because gold is a form of money that's going to hold its value while the dollar is inevitably inflated away. And what's happening in China now is interesting, because they have capital controls. Their people aren't allowed to for instance, buy things overseas at scale. And there's a lot of things they can't invest in domestically, but they're allowed to invest in gold. And they are worried about what's going to happen to their economy. So they're buying gold as a form of insurance against the crisis that they see coming in their currency and in their financial system. We should have that same attitude here. You know, so, you know, the gold bug attitude over the last 30 years of buying has served them pretty well, I think, now, because now they've got big stacks of gold and silver. Yeah, I don't think we should, have any kind of a religious attitude about any one asset. And I think the different variations in the precious metal space account for different points of view. For instance, you want precious metals, physical, where you can reach them as your replace currency. That's the base money in your financial life. And then from there, you can branch out into other precious metals related things like the mining stocks, which are, they're investments. They're not money, but they're potentially really lucrative investments. So you can stay kind of within the hard asset space where there's land and there's precious metals and there's some other commodity investments with your whole financial life. You know, you could build a portfolio that basically just covers the hard asset, the real asset waterfront. Those are things that governments can't create more of on electronic printing presses. And you can be in pretty good shape financially if you do that, because you'll be owning things that will tend to do all right in the kind of crisis that's probably coming. And that's the intellectual challenge. How do you want to set your portfolio up so that it's mostly in real assets? And, you know, which copper companies do you choose to invest in? Which gold miners? Things like that. There's a lot to think about, but it's, you know, it's containable. You can, a regular person can learn enough to be able to do that. And I think that's what we should all mostly be doing now.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I would agree with absolutely with both of you. I would add too, is be a part of a community, just because there's strength in numbers of a like-minded community. Whether that's a church group, or it doesn't even have to be that. It's just neighbors. If you live in the suburbs like me, I think that's a huge benefit. That, and then also just trying to be more self-reliant. We have a big garden here in the suburbs of Atlanta. I interviewed Bob several weeks ago, and he said his chickens, he has chickens, they're fresh eggs. I think anybody can do that kind of thing. And that would just give you, at the very least, give you a lot of confidence to be more self-reliant.
Yeah, if you can be 20% food self-sufficient, that's a huge cushion against whatever comes your way, you know? So that's something everybody should be aspiring to if they at all can do it, you know, if they're not cramped in some little city apartment. But if you've got some land, you should be growing stuff on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Any final thoughts, Bob? Before we say our goodbyes?
I believe gold and silver are going to continue going up, and across the commodity spectrum, the stock market is the highest it's ever been. Commodities are the cheapest they've ever been against the stock market. Gold and silver are the cheapest they've ever been against commodities, and the gold silver stocks are the cheapest they've ever been against gold. I follow sentiment closely, and I would highly encourage both of you, go to StockWatch right now and take a look at the volume on shares. Okay, if you got a portfolio of 20 or 30 stocks, take a look at the volume and you'll be staggered at how little interest there is in gold at near record levels and silver the highest in 20 years. Sentiment says nobody is buying into the rally, which tells me it's going a lot longer and a lot higher than anybody says. And it's an insurance policy. Why not pick up an insurance policy when it's cheap?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, any final thoughts or words, John, for me?
I've got a last question for Bob. So, yeah. Bob, where is silver going to top out in this cycle?
Well, I can answer that. I can tell you exactly what it's going to do.
We're all ears.
Tell me what price of gold or price of the dollar is going to be when it tops out.
Okay, let's say gold, 10,000.
No, you cheated.
Oh.
Okay, we were talking about two different commodities. You asked me for the price of one, and I'm saying, tell me what the price of the other is when that happens. Here's what I will say, okay? And I have follow silver very closely, but I'm not a silver bug. Silver bugs are shithouse crazy. Okay. Over the last 100 years, okay, and during half of that period, silver was money, and half of that period, silver is not money. The ratio between gold and silver has varied from about 17 to 1 to 130 to 1, but it's average 53 to 1. So when the ratio is above 53 to 1, I'm a buyer of silver, and below 53 to 1, I'm a seller of silver. The people running around saying we're going back to 17 or 18 to 1, I don't think it's true. I think in the ground, the ratio is more like 26 to 1, but still relatively meaningless. Silver is very cheap now, and I own a lot of silver. But where it's going, I can only describe in terms of gold, not in terms of the dollar, because I think the dollar is committing suicide. But I think the ratio could go back to 25 to 1, 30 to 1.
I'll take that. Yeah.
All right, gentlemen. I want to thank you so much for your time. We've gone on for about 45 minutes, and I want to be very respectful. But thank you so much. And yeah, just wish you guys the best. And I'd love to do this again sometime.
Thanks, Andy.
Well, it's a genuine pleasure. I mean, the crazy thing is I cannot tell you how many pieces we posted from dollar collapse. Okay, you broke my heart when you sold it. I just thought, my God, he's left me, he's deserted me. But I have all the respect in the world for you, and I've never talked to you, and I've never met you.
Yeah, it's about time. It's an honor to finally meet you, Bob. Looking forward to meeting you face-to-face one of these days, too, buying you a beer. Somehow. Yeah.
Only if I can tell.
You're in, Andy.
All right. All right. Thanks, gentlemen. Have a good day.
Thanks.